Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, Ned.
Ciao, Davide.
Where are you?
Well, I'm still at the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, I know that, but I mean, where are you?
Oh, okay. Sono ancora in Torino, nella mia piccola camera con tema Fiat 500.
Overly ambitious attempt to never stray far farly from the daily goings-on of this year's Giro d'Italia, Ned Bolting and I will be speaking every morning to recap the goings-on of the day before. I'm David Miller, and I'll be hosting this show from the comfort of my home in Girona.
And I'm Ned Bolting, and I don't know where I am.
Ned, how is Turin on race day?
Oh, well, I can't speak. It would be wrong, really, to speak for an entire Italian city. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of everybody who lives in Turin.
This isn't going to be good, is it?
But I can speak for myself, David. And you know, you've known me long enough to know that I'm quite excited. I'm still excited.
You're like waking me up before 7 o'clock for this excited, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. I love it.
I know. Let's ride the crest of the wave while it lasts. I'm so excited that, and bear in mind as well, I think my excitement is compounded by the fact that I was supposed to come to the Giro d'Italia last year, but because it overlapped with the Vuelta, because of the strange season, I couldn't do it. So I lost the opportunity to come here. And also bear in mind that we didn't go to France for the Tour de France last year. So I haven't kind of been on a grand tour on the ground for too long, really. So that's why I'm excited. And my excitement this morning has expressed itself in I should explain, really. I'm commentating for what's called the World Feed. I think I've explained this in the past, but just in case you're not sure. So I actually work for the Giro d'Italia. And they, if you like, they sell my commentary along with Matt Stevens, who is my co-commentator, across all these English-speaking territories in the world. Not in the UK, funnily enough. So I'm being employed by RCS, who own the Giro d'Italia. And because of that, David, this will amuse you.
When I
arrive and do the Giro d'Italia for them, I am given on arrival 3 enormous plastic bags full of Navigare, which is Navigare clothing.
RCS like
branded
merch.
Clothing. All with the hashtags all over it, Amore Infinito and all this sort of thing. Like, it's so Italian. And
that's horrible.
And then what begins is a kind of silent, unspoken battle between me and my RCS employers as to whether or not I ever put any of it on.
Unlike Matt Rendell.
Matt just takes it as an opportunity to throw away all his old clothing and for the next year all he'll wear is Amore Infinito clothing. But as you can see, I'm so excited.
Look at that, it's not bad.
This is the most acceptable of all of them.
Harvey wants to see it. Come and see.
What I'm now showing to David on Zoom is a relatively restrained navy blue t-shirt with Giro d'Italia and Amore Infinito on the front. And
it's a little bit considered. You know, it's not crazy.
It's not totally crazy. The item of clothing I think I'm going to balk at is a sleeveless, padded, rather metallic finish kind of gilet.
That just rings Giro d'Italia for me. I can just picture it now. Then we'll scurry around with greased
hair. It's so Giro.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. It's true, though, isn't it? They're all just kitted up in like their chinos and hair slicked back and shiny gilets. It used to be the old Aeronautica stuff, didn't it?
Yeah. Aeronautica Militare, or was it?
That was it. It was like the least military stuff you've ever seen, unless you were going to... I'm not going to go there. But
No, probably not. probably best not. So that's the level of my excitement. Yeah.
So your excitement went to the degree of you actually running the TT course yesterday, am I right?
Yes. It turned out to be quite a long run because I had to get to the start. I had to run to the start, which was 3 kilometres across town. I found the start, and then I ran the course, and it was extremely hot, and I was extremely slow, and it was an extremely beautiful course, and it couldn't be more kind of chocolate box touristy. It's going to be very beautiful. You know, I think we've got quite familiar with. Happened in France, didn't it, a couple of times, and it's happened in Milan during COVID, that actually the city authorities have tended to want the races to kind of leave the city centre so they don't attract the big crowds and it doesn't kind of... But actually, Turin's just gone, do you know what? In for a penny, in for a pound. Let's ram the race right the way through the centre of this really rather beautiful city. So it leaves from, if anyone knows Turin, it leaves from the Piazza Castello, which is a really kind of the central point in the middle of Turin. There is an old castle in the middle of the city, which has a very interesting history, by the way, that I didn't realise some of it. And then it goes past the Giardini Reali, which is this little park in the middle of town, down the Corso San Maurizio to join northern embankment of the River Po, the Lungo Po. And then it gets very straight. So you're about a kilometre into the race then. And then you've got another 2.5-3 kilometres, which are just straight along the river, passing through... the Parco del Valentino that I talked about yesterday, where we had the team presentation on Thursday night. Then it kind of wiggles around a bit to get onto, and then the first technical section, it's not really that technical, as it just wiggles around through a slip road to get onto a river called the Ponte Principessa Isabella, crosses there, and goes then along the Corso Moncalieri, which is the embankment on the other side, on the south side of the river, in the opposite direction, and then that you've got 3.5 kilometres straight to the finish. 8.6 kilometres in total. I think it's I don't know if you've managed to look at the profile or anything, David, but I think it's super fast.
It's just a Ghana destruction.
It looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like it.
Cavagna's going pretty well, isn't he? I'd say the interesting one tomorrow is going to be Evenepoel. I mean, I'm going to say that every single day, but it's true because it's his first race back and it's proper. It's going to be.
Have you seen who goes off a minute after Remco Evenepoel?
No, I haven't.
Philippe Ogana.
Ooh.
So they'll be on the road at the same time, which will be pretty. That'll be pretty amazing.
That will be good. Oh, well, that's nice. What else about Turin? Because I don't really know much about Turin. I know there's a velodrome there, isn't there? Or used to be.
There is. There is an old velodrome. Now, what's it called?
We've had this discussion before, haven't we?
Yes, and I think you had a bit of kind of additional information or you remembered it having...
Raced it because Milan Turin, which is like one of the oldest kind of semi-classics, if you like, used to finish in the velodrome. That's it. It's the Moto Velodromo Fausto Coppi. Is that
correct?
It?
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Yes.
Yeah. And it's kind of falling to pieces because it's where he did the hour record, hence why it's named after him, I believe. But it's a beautiful old... It was built in the late 1800s, I believe. And it's just a beautiful old velodrome, but I think it's just fallen into disrepair of late. I think it was Matt Rendell that told us it had fallen into disrepair. He'd gone and looked around.
No, it was me. It was me, actually. It dates back from the last time I came and commentated on the Giro d'Italia, 2016. The final stage 21, finished not in the velodrome, because as you say, it was kind of crumbling, but just up the road from the velodrome. And in the morning, I just strolled down to go and have a look at it, and I wouldn't say broke in because I wasn't kind of stealing over fences, but I just kind of wandered in, and there was some sort of car boot sale or something going on in the middle, and it was rather sad because all the concrete off the embankment, it's open air velodrome, quite big, sort of 450, 500 metres possibly round, was kind of crumbling. And I got talking to a few of the people from the velodrome who were saying that they were trying to organise a local committee to raise funds to get it restored. So and at that time I was quite heavily involved, or starting to get quite heavily involved, in Herne Hill Velodrome in London, which had just kind of done just that, and you know, raised the funds to have the it resurfaced and redeveloped. So I don't know what the... That's a very good question. I must try and find out if they ever...
It's beautiful. I recommend people going onto Google and looking it up, because it's got some beautiful entrance architecture and all very classic. It's an amazing place. It's sad that it's falling to pieces, if that's the case. But Turin. But yeah, so Milan Turin used to finish there, and it's used to have these climbers would come into there, and it was one of the funniest sprints in cycling, because you'd have a bunch of climbers trying to sprint on a velodrome, and you'd never really been on a velodrome before. It was just a comedy of errors. So you either had to be on your own or risk death amongst 10 climbers trying to sprint for the finish.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, were you ever involved in the... Did you ever get involved in the final?
Yeah, I was
in the
sprint for second, I think, in a group of like 9, but I was as bad as everybody else. And, I thought I was going to dominate it, and then realised I'd never sprinted on a velodrome either. So I joined the ranks of useless climbers on a velodrome.
That's
my story.
Like a rubbish version of Philippe Gilbert when he won Paris-Roubaix the other year and he'd never sprinted on a velodrome before.
About as far removed from Philippe Gilbert as possible. Oh, well, very good. And so what else is going on over there? Is there any scoops?
The scoop is 160 years ago, Italy was unified. And that's the scoop. The first kingdom of Italy was declared. And the first king ascended to the throne, who is, of course, King Victor Emmanuel II. Which is why, you know, a bit like in France, as we often comment, David, everything is either Place Georges Clemenceau or Avenue Jean Jaurès. Well, Vittorio Emanuele is one of the names you just see everywhere in Italy. The first king of Italy. And the first capital city of Italy was Turin.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that until I kind of started scratching around with its history. But it was only quite brief. And the reason it wasn't Rome initially that was declared the capital city was because Rome still, I think I've got this right, belonged to the Papal States. Obviously, the seat of the Vatican and everything. And it took some time, I think decades, before Rome was eventually declared the Italian capital. And in the meantime, actually, Turin was only the capital city for a relatively few years. 3 years after 1861, so in 1864, I alluded to this yesterday, they had a big exhibition there to kind of declare Turin's importance as the new capital city, the new state. But not long after that, they moved the capital from Turin to Florence because, for a couple of reasons, really, because I think Florentine Italian was considered a higher kind of caste of the spoken language and the written language. And also, Turin's just a little bit too uncomfortably close to France geographically. France, and it was far from stable, was it? The kind of Franco-Italian border. So that's that. Yeah, there's a bit of Turin for you.
Yeah,
45 stage starts in Turin and 40 finishes down the years. So very much a big part of the Giro d'Italia.
What are we looking at this first week? That we went briefly on it yesterday, but regards the kind of actual roots of this race and who are the people to look for this first week, do you reckon?
Glad you've asked me that, because I've got, with that in mind, I've got a slight little kind of shrewdy dark horse outsider for today's time trial, or just one to watch. I don't think for a second he's going to win it, but I do think he's a rider worth keeping an eye on, although his form hasn't been visible so far this year. But looking at the EF Education Nippo team, rider 107 I think's of interest, and that's Alberto Bettiol.
Ooh, he has had a quiet start to the year, hasn't he?
I think he has, yeah, which probably blows a massive hole in what I've just said. But the winner of the Tour of Flanders from 2 years ago...
He's got something to prove.
I think he's... on his day, I think he's a really good time trialist. And the year that he went on to win Flanders, he finished on the podium. Did he win it? He came very close to winning the final time trial of... Tirreno Adriatico, which, as you know, is not dissimilar to this time trial.
I think you're right. And I think he was podium.
Certainly a podium. He might have even won it. And he beat Rowan Dennis. and one or two others on that occasion, and then went on to win the Tour of Flanders. Now, I don't think he's going to win this, but I think it's... riders like him, and another rider we can talk about, you might be able to guess who, I think it's of importance to them that they don't lose, you know, they're close, that they're pretty close because of what's to come on stage in the first week of racing and the possibility of getting the jersey.
Mind you, Gannon's no slouch on the climbs after the Vuelta last year, so it's going to be, yeah. But yeah, I agree, Bettioli's got something to prove in Italy, because he's also got that little bit of a problem with the Gazzetta and stuff. Wasn't that his statement when he won Flanders last year, that he was annoyed that the Italian press didn't fet him or recognise him? So
yeah, what was his celebration? Wasn't it a bit like told, you know, shush?
Wasn't it like, yeah, was it shush or kind of his eyes, pointed his eyes and shush? I can't remember. It was something a bit weird, but it was a bit petulant and angry. You know,
Who did that the other day? Mark Soler, who won't win the Giro because he doesn't have the temperament to win a Grand Tour. He brilliantly won that stage at the Tour de Romandie last week, didn't he? And he did the old shush over the line to all his doubters, David, to me, basically.
So you've just taken it on board.
Yeah. I've just cranked the doubt up to 10.
Poor Mark.
So today's the time trial. Tomorrow, by the way, I don't want to dwell too much on tomorrow because we can talk about tomorrow, but just a little heads up, the stage starts tomorrow, and by the way, they're showing on the television all of every stage.
Oh, they're not, you poor bugger. Oh,
thank you, no commercial breaks either.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. You really are going to know everything.
I went out and bought a kettle.
Yeah.
From a shop with that in mind. So we're going to have kettle, we're going to have tea, and I've taken some Yorkshire tea bags with me to the Giro d'Italia. Tomorrow's stage start is absolutely stunningly beautiful. I won't talk about that now because I'm not going to tell you now.
Don't ruin it. Save it. We've got a lot to get through every day.
I'll save it. No, tomorrow's 179K and it's very flat and it kind of runs along the... it runs actually northeast. It's kind of weirdly, we go back into... sort of deeper into Piedmont before eventually the race brings us south. Stage three is one of those... And straight away, it's one of those kind of beautiful... Ooh, really hard to read kind of... Giro stages that you'd associate with Tirreno Adriatico, where you get a little kind of a couple
kickers.
Of little
right
kickers, yeah. David.
Yeah, nice. There's kickers.
Two kilometer climb in the final 5K, and it's got a 15% section in that, so kind of perfect,
yeah.
Indeterminate territory there, which will probably shell a few of the heavier sprinters out.
That's got Remco attacking from 50Ks out. All over at that stage.
Or Soler.
Yeah, I mean, he's got nothing to lose. He's already lost it, so he may as well go. Next stage. Then you've got the first summit finish on stage four.
Yeah, well, it's... Yeah,
it's
it is.
Summit finish.
I've coloured it in as a GC day. I've kind of put a little pink... I've put a pink highlighter thing, but it may not turn out to be that way. It's kind of... Slightly betwixt and between, isn't it? It's very early for
4Ks at 10%, they're saying. That final
climb. That's not nothing, is it?
No, that's not lame. That's really, really hard for 95% of the peloton. So that's going to be really interesting.
It flattens out, doesn't it? There's a 2 kilometre plateau sort of thing, but that's
after
neither here nor there.
4Ks of 10%.
Yeah, true.
That old chestnut.
But I don't know whether to call that a summit finish.
No,
I'd call that an uphill finish, isn't it?
Okay, an uphill finish.
Is that all right? Are we happy?
That's fine. I'm happy with that. That's cool.
It's very important to me, these things, David. They may seem like kind of trivial details, but before a Grand Tour gets underway, if you're commentating on it, there is it's such a strange phenomenon. There is too much information that you could possibly draw together and assimilate from the ascent of King Victor Emmanuel II in 1861 to Alberto Bettiol's current form, to whether or not stage four ends in a summit finish. It's like trying to fill up an entire bath using a sieve, you know, to trans- honestly, it's so difficult. But then, actually, strangely, when the race gets underway, the detail that is relevant kind of comes out into three-dimensional relief, doesn't it? And then you kind of cast aside the bits that don't matter so much. It's very strange, but at the moment, it's shapeless at the moment, and that's why I'm panicking. Yeah.
A lot of the time as well, with even the riders do that. It's quite overwhelming to look at the whole race. You get there and then you start looking at it. Although you've had a glance over and you do know, obviously, if you're a GC going for the race of the win, you're doing recon and everything. But generally, the riders just wait till they get there and take it. I know that it's become almost painful hearing it, but the day-by-day saying, it's because it's the only way you can take it in, because otherwise it's just overwhelming. It's horrible.
Did you approach a Grand Tour in that sense, in the same way that you sometimes approach commentating on a Grand Tour?
Very much short, just turning up.
You know what I'm getting at here, where open the roadbook and you go, oh, summit finish.
That did. Even in my younger days, I was like that. I just turn up and you'd have a look, and I'd have picked out a couple of stages and had an overview of what the race was going to be like. I'd, you know, there were time trials and where they were and what they were like and the hardest mountain stages and if there was one or two road stages. But often I would turn up, and especially the Vuelta, just be looking through the book, sitting on my bed like the night before, going, ooh, this is quite hard. That one will be okay. I might better take it easy there. And yeah, but I mean, and to be frank, back then, that's what most of us did, because, you know, it was just, it kind of made it more fun. I think if you'd been looking at it for months before, you wouldn't turn up. You'd be like, nah, I'm not going there. That looks ridiculous. Especially the Giro. The Giro is the worst for it as well. My first Giro was 2008, and I was just shocked and awed by how horribly difficult it was. Because I think we were averaging 4,000 metres a day climbing most of the time. And we had 2 6,000 metre back-to-back days in the final week. I mean, it was just, yeah, I swore never to go back, and I did. But then from that moment on with the Giro, I never looked at it. Just turned up and got it done. But that, I think, and honestly, Ned, I think still a lot of riders do that. I think it's actually makes it more enjoyable and a bit more fun. Kind of, where are we going next? Like the mystery race we used to talk about. Mystery distance.
Yeah.
Open the book, not knowing where you're going.
Yeah.
Oh, happy days. Yeah.
Like a kind of, like a racing advent calendar. Open the door and what's in. Terrible start for, I probably shouldn't name him, so I'm not going to name him, but I got a message from a rider at the Giro quite late last night saying, not an ideal start to the Giro. A crown has just come off one of my teeth and I'm in the dentist's chair having emergency dental repairing work. Yeah. Oh. So that's, imagine that being your start to the Giro.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not
so
good.
I should keep his identity confidential. By now, we have left Piedmont and we are in Emilia-Romagna as we head south. Stage 5 is flat again, opportunity for the sprinters. That's Wednesday. Then stage 6 on Thursday is a summit finish, properly.
Oh, that
and
is.
This is Ascoli Piceno, right? 15.5 kilometre climb. The final 5K are a proper climb. They're kind of 7-8%.
They haven't done since 2002. Yeah.
It's not a familiar climb to me, I must admit. So
no, I don't know that one at all. But yeah, you're right. That classifies as a summit finish, Ned. I'll give you that.
Good. By now, we're going from Marche into Abruzzo, heading to the Adriatic coast. So we've kind of done a diagonal, you know, southeastern trajectory at this point. And there's a possibility, although you've discussed this in the past, David, it doesn't seem to affect the Giro, but if it's going to affect the Giro, this is a day where potentially you could have some wind.
Yeah, I mean, along the coast. I'm still trying to remember. I mean, you've watched more race in Italy of late. Can you remember seeing echelons in Italy? No. It just doesn't happen here. Weirdest thing. Oh, well, there you go. Can live in hope.
Then at the weekend, so next weekend, there are two GC days in a row, really. My notes here on stage 7, which finishes at Guardia San Framondi, 170k. It's a 3 kilometre climb at the end that's about 8%. And I'd originally written in my notes summit finish, but I'd crossed it out and put uphill finish instead. So
I love your classification system.
Just so you know. And then on stage 9, Sunday, Campo Felice is another uphill finish.
Oh, that's stretching it, but yeah, okay.
Okay, you're going summit finish, 6.6K?
Don't know. Okay. I mean, it looks, because you've just come up at like a 10-12k climb, then you've got the little descent, then up another one.
All right, let's
definitely get it. But I'll go uphill finish. Go on then. It's fine.
I think it's definitely a GC day, though, Sunday, yes. I think, without a shadow of doubt. Partly because, and this makes stage 10, which is the final stage before the rest day, a real opportunity, I think, for the first breakaway.
Oh, yeah, especially with the climb at the beginning. Yeah.
Almost nailed on to go to Foligno, which is, if you know Foligno, is in it's in Umbria, and it's an absolute feature of Tirreno Adriatico, which passes through that territory. Foligno always features one way or another in Tirreno Adriatico, and there we go. We'll probably pause it there because that's the end of the first block of racing. So ten stages before a rest day. 10.
Just rattled by that. God, I hope Marc Soler's in the race at that point. That's going to be I'm just going to be tracking him day by day now.
All depends on his temperament. Doesn't it, David?
His temperament. But he's got no one to fight against. And his team, in the team this year, he's got outright leadership.
Oh, someone on Twitter told us what the word for the two-pronged fork was, because there is a word.
Of course there is.
But I can't remember what it was. I did read it somewhere. Abident? No, I can't remember.
Abident, brilliant.
Yeah, but this is a mono... A monodent, isn't it, Marc Soler?
Yeah.
Some questions, because we did put out a little appeal. I think we should make it a regular feature if people want to carry on asking us questions. Go on, you shoot up. Shoot with the first one, Dave.
I'm going to choose a couple of best books you've read recently.
Do you want to start?
You start, because I've got to think, because that just caught me off. And I'm just having to think.
Okay, so I have mentioned this on Twitter, so if you've been following my feed, it won't surprise you, but I've become very enamoured with George Orwell recently, and because many people in Britain, I kind of was introduced to Orwell at school, where you read Animal Farm and you dimly understand it when you're 14 years old, and then you read 1984 after that, and you kind of dimly understand that, and it's all a bit, well, it is what it is. I mean, they're kind of important. They're important books, but they're not books that I've ever gone back to read. And then my mum, who's a member of a book club, sent me after her book club had done it. She sent me in the post her secondhand copy of Coming Up for Air, which is a novel about kind of suburban misery in the interwar years and Britain. And kind of Orwell has this very bleak take on kind of metropolitan life, and I loved it, and I thought it was amusing and subtle and all these things that 1984 and kind of Animal Farm aren't. I thought it was just a beautifully crafted, very believable, wonderful book, and then I started just going back through his oeuvre, so to speak, and at the moment I'm reading Keep the Aspidistras Flying by George Orwell, which is not dissimilar actually to Coming Up for Air, and it's just surprising that some, I thought I knew Orwell, and it turns out I don't really. But
that's amazing. I actually did order some books. You know, sometimes you give books away. Well, I think we both do, and then you kind of regret it, and you're trying to find where they are. I've got a brilliant book that I just got back again, or two or three of them actually, restocking my shelves. It's called Moondust, and it's the biographies, kind of mini biographies of the men that stood on the moon. Each one of their experiences, kind of a little bio before they got there, but more about what happens to them when they got back. And they were each chosen, obviously, in this 1950s, 60s. They're all test pilots, scientists, essentially atheists. They were almost kind of selected for that sort of, to avoid any spiritual issues, if you like. But what happened was every single one of them came back and either turned to religion or became very spiritual in one way or another. The only person who didn't admit it, never admitted it, was Neil Armstrong. He never spoke about his experiences, but every single one of them came back and was a completely changed person. It's an amazing wow. book, because especially when you put it in the context of what these men were like. They'd come out of the Second World War, Korean War. They were test pilots. They were hardcore scientists as well, and just really chosen for that cold, calculated nature. And they all came back and were just totally... The experience just changed their mind forever. So I thought Moondust.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Fabulous book. And I'm reading another one which I can't remember at the moment. It's on my Kindle next to my bed, but it's another sci-fi one. I must have something in my head at the moment about space again. We need to get John Noonan back on, but it comes in waves. So that's about where I am on books. What other questions are there, Ned?
James Farmer asks, and I've adapted this question slightly just to simplify it and bring us both in. If you had to share a room on the tour, who would you prefer to share it with, Chris Boardman or Gary Imlek?
Oh my God!
Can you imagine?
No. I gotta go, Chris. Every day of the week, it's Gary. Would be it would be.
You wouldn't get any sleep with Gary. You wouldn't get much sleep, would you? Because you'd kind of like, 2:30 in the morning. You'd peep an eye open and you'd see the light of his laptop in the corner, and he'd be making notes. He'd be working on the highlight scripts, wouldn't he, for the following day? It would just be,
be relentless. The pressure to know. You were talking just before about the fact that there's so much information to absorb.
Well, that's Gary actually knows it. He doesn't use a sieve. He uses an actual saucepan to
He's phenomenal. So he'd just be up there scouring, looking for information, trying to know more. And
I'm not saying that sharing a room with Chris Boardman would be a cakewalk either. That would be a bit strange as well, wouldn't it?
It would be very strange. I don't know. I guess there's a part of me that thinks that would hope he'd just turn into chatty Chris, just laying there, like little bedtime stories as he's just laying in the bed next to you, just chit-chatting away like a totally different human. But I don't think that would happen. I think just read his book and just disappear.
It'd be quite interesting to see how efficiently he went to sleep and how efficiently he woke up.
Efficiently he went to sleep. That'd be so good. But speaking of that, that's a good question, because you'd always have that on grand tours. You'd always want to make sure you were with the right person. And some people were...
This brings it back to the Giro. Let's not stray too far from the Giro, David. You roomed with Ryder Hegdal when he won the Giro, right?
No, it wasn't, but I used to room with Ryder. I wasn't there, unfortunately.
In that race?
I was gutted, because I swore not to go back after the year before. But no, Ryder was, I think for a lot of us, actually, everyone wanted a room with Ryder, because he was just so chilled out and funny. And there were some riders you definitely did not want to room with, but with Ryder, it was just hilarious. So people used to always fight for him, bless him. unless it's neurotic, but
what do you think of, I can't remember who asked us this question, it landed last night, so apologies for not remembering your name, but it did stick in my memory. I think someone's just asked us because we're recording really early in the morning. What are you about to have for breakfast, or what have you had for breakfast, David, in Girona?
What a fascinating question, Ned.
That's a good question, isn't it? It gives me an opportunity to talk about Italian breakfast. That's really why I'm asking.
To be honest, I don't really eat until a bit later. I have like a couple of coffees for the kids, and then the kids don't have coffee, obviously. just sitting there with a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old drinking espresso. paints a great picture, doesn't it? I just get like a sandwich later on. It's quite continental, isn't it, to go and get a sandwich from somewhere around 10 o'clock, like a ham sandwich. That's about it, really. The beautiful spreads you get in Italy.
Well,
the dry spreads.
Italian food is great. So I think we used the phrase on yesterday's podcast, Italy... overwhelms, but also can underwhelm. Yes. What is going on with their breakfasts, right? Why do they just give up? So everything, lunch is just a massive ritual, isn't it? And there's all sorts of stuff like that. Dinner, obviously, is kind of endlessly wonderful and all that sort of thing. Breakfast, just, who cares? Even the word. So the word for breakfast in Italian is la colazione, the collection. It's whatever, isn't it? It's whatever. But it's stale bits of cake. It's a boiled egg in a big sort of Pyrex bowl full of boiled eggs. A yogurt. Should we put it in the fridge? No, we'll just leave it out on the counter so it gets nice and warm. And then where it really lets itself down is those bread rolls.
Oh, they're just rock solid.
Just driest thing.
Spain used to have that like 20 years ago. But they stopped doing it. You know, they got pretty good breakfast in Spain now. Amazing. France is pretty good. Germany's got amazing breakfast. UK is pretty special at breakfast. But it's interesting when you think about Anglo-Saxon countries, and perhaps this is where we've got it wrong. We kind of hit out hard at breakfast. And
massively.
It's almost like the highlight of the day.
Yeah.
Whereas Italians, they're like, yeah, this sucks. Breakfast this morning sucks. Let's just admit it. Let's just face it. The rest of the day is going to get better.
You're
just going to be pretty good. By the time we get to the evening, it's going to be amazing.
Whereas I think
with UK, it just gets worse and worse and worse.
We hit out early.
It's true. It's like, what?
We're like Pierre Roland on Alpe d'Huez.
Yeah. It's not even that. Imagine that. Imagine Italian turning up and seeing like a full English like cooking food. Like, and there's like sausages and beans and
hash browns, mushrooms, tomatoes out of a tin.
And it's just the same thing every place. They're like, what are you people? And it's like, what do you have for lunch? A sandwich? Go to Pret. And it's like, and then by the time you're like snacking, not really hungry for dinner, just being like wasting the rest of the day, burning off breakfast, which was pretty crap to be honest, but I was so hungry, it was amazing. Yeah. There's a logic to it. Yeah, very good.
Oh, last thing, Pierre Roland won stage 6 of the Tour de Rwanda yesterday.
Did he?
He's back.
I saw pictures of it. Yeah. It's beautiful there.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Isn't it? It's like it's properly lush.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I need to look more into Rwanda. Oh, well done, Roland. That's, who did he ride for now? I don't even know.
B&B Hotels Vital Concept. Do you remember? It was going to be Kenyuk. Because Kenyuk was going to sign as Pierre Roland's fixer.
Right.
Do you remember
that? Right, the fixer,
Get him in the move. Get Roland in the move.
Yeah, very good.
And my last thing is, Johan de Munck won the Giro d'Italia in 78. And I think I said 76 yesterday.
So 78.
Well, he's not actually. I think you might have misunderstood that. I think there is a butcher. I think there is a butcher called Johan de Munck. Evenepoel's village. I don't think, unless I've got the story wrong, because I've just read it in Flemish and in Dutch, and I'm not necessarily the best at that. So maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe that is actually Johan de Munck.
But that's why I think it's highly possible of that generation of rider to have then become a butcher. I think it's within the realms of possibility.
I don't doubt it's possible.
Okay,
rather than research it and find out the actual answer, just leave it floating there as a possibility.
It's a floater. It's a floating fact.
It's a floating fact. Never Strays Farfalle, anchored in floating facts.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.